Ever get that feeling? Like you're drowning in information and you just wish someone would point you to like the most important stuff.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, so you could actually like understand the core ideas without having to wade through a mountain of textbooks.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty common feeling these days. There's just so much out there. Figuring out what's really insightful can be a real challenge.
Well, that's kind of what we try to do here on the Deep Dive, right? And speaking of insightful material, you brought us something pretty fascinating this time, a scholarly article titled Isoperimetry and Hypercontractivity by Michel Ledoux.
It's a dense paper, that's for sure, but it's packed with some really powerful ideas.
So for this deep dive, our mission is to really distill the essence of two key concepts that Ledoux explores: isoperimetric inequalities and something called the concentration of measure phenomenon. And we'll be looking at these ideas specifically within the framework of Gaussian analysis.
Right. And the goal here isn't just to get a kind of abstract theoretical understanding. We want to uncover why these concepts are so powerful, why they're such essential tools in so many different areas. By the end of our conversation, you should have a good grasp of what makes these ideas so important.
Okay, so let's start unpacking this. Isoperimetry. Now that sounds like something we might have encountered back in high school geometry class.
Yeah, you're on the right track. At its most basic level, isoperimetry is all about the relationship between the size of a set and the size of its boundary.
Okay.
Think about a simple example. If you have a fixed length of rope, what shape can you enclose that will give you the largest possible area?
A circle.
Exactly. That's a classic example of an isoperimetric inequality in action. The circle is the most efficient way to enclose a given area with a fixed perimeter.
Right, the most bang for your buck in terms of fencing in the biggest space.
Yeah.
But this article seems to be going way beyond circles and squares, right?
Absolutely. Ledoux's work and our focus here is on isoperimetric inequalities in more abstract mathematical spaces, specifically those related to something called Gaussian measures.
Oh, Gaussian measures. Now, does that have something to do with the bell curve? The normal distribution from like basic statistic?
That's it. A Gaussian measure is essentially an extension of the normal distribution to higher dimensions.
Okay, so we're not just talking about single variables anymore, but whole collections of them.
Precisely. And what's really interesting, as Ledoux points out, is that a lot of the early development of these Gaussian isoperimetric and concentration inequalities, particularly in the context of things like Banach spaces, which are kind of infinite dimensional vector space that allow us to study functions and other more complex objects, was driven by a whole group of really remarkable mathematicians.
Okay, so who are we talking about here?
Names like Bedrickian, Borel, Erhard, Fernique, Landau, Shep, Milman, Talleyrand, really a who's who of modern probability theory.
Wow, that's quite the lineup of pioneers. And Ledoux mentions that much of the inspiration for this work actually came from analysis, not necessarily from traditional probability theory. That's kind of surprising.
It is a fascinating point. There was a strong emphasis on establishing these fundamental inequalities within a very rigorous analytic framework. And because of that, because of this strong analytical flavor back in the 70s and 80s, these concepts actually felt somewhat foreign to probabilists and even to analysts who were working on Wiener spaces, which are a key setting for studying random processes over time.
So it started out as a fairly specialized area, and now it's something with much broader applications.
Exactly.
Okay, so we have this general idea of isoperimetric inequalities. Now, what happens when we zero in on the Gaussian isoperimetric inequality? What's the key insight there?
Well, when we're talking about Gaussian measure on MathBia, just our standard n-dimensional space, the Gaussian isoperimetric inequality says something pretty elegant. It states that among all sets in this space that have a given amount of Gaussian measure, half spaces have the smallest Gaussian surface area.
Okay, hold on. Half spaces. What exactly are those?
Imagine taking MathBio and slicing it in half with a perfectly flat plane.
Okay, so one side of a hyperplane, basically.
Precisely. So no matter how complicated or irregular a set you can imagine, if it contains the same amount of Gaussian probability as some half space, its boundary measured in a Gaussian sense will always be at least as large as that of the half space. The key takeaway here is that even in these very complex probability landscapes, the simplest shape, a half space, is the most efficient way to contain a given amount of probability mass.
I see. So it's almost like there's this underlying efficiency principle at play, even in these probabilistic spaces.
That's a good way to think about it.
Now, the article mentions a couple different ways to prove this. Can you talk about those?
Yeah, there are two main approaches that Ledoux highlights. One method relies on the known isoperimetric inequality for spheres and then uses a kind of limiting argument. Imagine zooming in on a very high-dimensional sphere. It's an idea that's credited to Borel, Sudikov, and Cyrilson. And then the other major proof, developed by Earhart, uses a technique called Gaussian symmetrization.
Okay, Gaussian symmetrization. What's that all about?
You can think of it as a way to systematically reshape a set into a more symmetric form closer to a half space without changing its Gaussian measure.
Okay.
And the proof shows that this process can only decrease the Gaussian surface area.
Interesting.
Now, both of these proofs, as Ledoux points out, tend to be quite technically demanding.
So not exactly something you'd scribble out on a napkin.
Right. But Ledoux also points out that there's a more recent proof discovered by Bobkov that's considered much simpler and more streamlined. It uses something called a sharp two-point isoperimetric inequality and, believe it or not, the central limit theorem, you know, one of the cornerstones of probability theory.
Wow, so this simpler proof connects to some very fundamental ideas.
It does. And what's interesting is that Ledoux draws a parallel between this proof and Gross's original proof of something called the logarithmic Sobolev inequality for Gaussian measures. It kind of sidesteps all the complicated symmetrization techniques of the earlier proofs.
That's always nice in math, right? When a simpler and more elegant proof comes along.
Definitely.
Okay, so we got a handle on isoperimetry in this Gaussian setting. Now, our outline shifts to the concentration of measure phenomenon. What's the basic idea behind this?
So the concentration of measure phenomenon essentially tells us that if a set within a probability space has a large enough measure, meaning it contains a significant chunk of the total probability, then most of the remaining measure is concentrated in a very small neighborhood around that set.
Okay, let me see if I'm getting this. So if you have this big region where most of the probability sits, then you're saying that almost all the probability isn't just inside that region, but it's also crammed into a tight band right around it.
Exactly. That's the intuition. Now, Ledoux makes a point of saying that while concentration is certainly related to isoperimetry, after all, a set with a small boundary kind of holds on to its measure, the study of concentration can be a bit different, especially when you start looking at larger enlargements of sets, not just the immediate boundary.
Enlargements. So like adding a buffer zone around our probability-rich region.
Precisely. And to make this precise, Ledoux introduces this thing called the concentration function. It's often denoted as alpha. And you can think of it as telling you, for a given set allers with a certain measure, what's the probability of finding significant probability outside a buffer zone of size true dollars around that set? And a key observation in lots of important cases is that this concentration function decays like a Gaussian. It drops off incredibly fast, much faster than a polynomial, for example, just like the tail of a bell curve.
So in many scenarios, things are much more predictable and tightly clustered than we might initially think.
Right. And as you might guess, isoperimetric inequalities turn out to be a very powerful tool for establishing these concentration inequalities.
Okay.
But Ledoux also mentions other methods like martingale inequalities, which were particularly championed by Moret in the context of Banach spaces.
Martingale inequalities. Those sound familiar from probability theory.
Yeah, the basic idea there is to break down a complicated random variable into a sum of simpler ones called martingale differences, and then use some classical probability results to bound the overall deviations.
It's fascinating how all these different branches of probability theory kind of intertwine and support each other.
It really is.
Now, the outline mentions a simpler way to prove a concentration inequality using Lipschitz functions and the Ornstein-Uhlenbeck semigroup. That sounds promising.
Yeah, this is proposition 2.1 in Ledoux's article, and he actually emphasizes its elementary nature. So it starts with the Lipschitz function, call it $1. And a Lipschitz function is essentially one that doesn't change too abruptly. So if you move a little bit in the input, the output doesn't jump wildly. And the Lipschitz norm kind of quantifies how much it's allowed to change.
Wow.
So the proposition looks at these Lipschitz functions that have zero average under the Gaussian measure, and it gives you a bound on the probability that this function deviates a lot from its mean, which is zero in this case. And the bound has this nice exponential form.
Okay, but what about this Ornstein-Uhlenbeck semigroup thing? I remember seeing that term in the article. How does that fit into this simpler proof?
Right. The Ornstein-Uhlenbeck semigroup, written as PD2, is a collection of mathematical operators that act on functions.
Okay.
You can think of them as a kind of smoothing process, like blurring an image.
Hmm.
And Ledoux points out that this semigroup has a very special property. It commutes with the gradient operator, which basically measures how quickly a function is changing. And this commutation property, along with a technique called integration by parts, lets you derive the concentration inequality in a pretty straightforward way. You basically analyze how the exponential of the function evolves under the action of the semigroup.
So you're kind of watching how the function behaves under this blurring process. And from that, you can deduce something about how concentrated its values are.
That's a really good intuition. And then proposition 2.1 becomes the foundation for proving all sorts of other concentration inequalities that have that characteristic Gaussian decay. Inequalities 2.8 and 2.9 in the article are good examples.
Okay.
And Ledoux actually points out that while you could try to use isoperimetric inequalities to get to these results, this semigroup approach is often much more direct and simpler, and it's perfectly sufficient for lots of applications.
It's amazing how these abstract mathematical tools can give you such concrete insights into how probabilities behave.
It really is.
Now, our outline moves on to concentration and product spaces, particularly the work of Michel Talleyrand.
Ah, yes, Michel Talleyrand, a real giant in this field. His work on concentration inequalities in product spaces was absolutely groundbreaking.
Okay.
He looked at spaces like M-Dale, which represents all the possible sequences of zeros and ones.
Okay, like binary strings.
Exactly. And the distance he focused on was the Hamming distance, which just counts the number of positions where two of these sequences differ.
Okay, like comparing two binary codes and seeing how many bits have been flipped.
Exactly. So Talleyrand came up with this incredibly clever and powerful proof technique based on mathematical induction on the number of coordinates, none other.
Okay.
And this allowed him to prove concentration inequalities that, remarkably, didn't depend on the dimension in a complicated way.
That sounds kind of counterintuitive, right?
Yeah.
In these high-dimensional spaces, things usually get much more complex.
They do. But Talleyrand's genius was realizing that by cleverly breaking these problems down coordinate by coordinate, he could prove concentration results that were surprisingly independent of the dimension. It was a huge breakthrough for dealing with the so-called curse of dimensionality in many fields.
So even in these vast high-dimensional spaces, if you have a set of these binary sequences that has a decent amount of probability, almost all of that probability is concentrated within a surprisingly small Hamming distance.
That's exactly right.
Wow, that's pretty remarkable.
It is. And Theorem 3.1 in Ledoux's article actually extends this idea to an even more general setting where you have these Hamming metrics that allow you to weight the contribution of each coordinate differently.
Okay.
And this theorem really highlights the power of Talleyrand's inductive method and his use of these exponential integral inequalities as recurrence hypotheses.
Sounds like he built a really robust and flexible framework.
He did.
The outline also mentions Theorem 3.2, which seems to have some pretty big implications for things like sums of independent random variables and probability in Banach spaces.
Yeah, so Theorem 3.2 essentially shows that the probability of a sample from this product space deviating from some set decays exponentially fast with the number of coordinates you're allowed to ignore. And Ledoux stresses that this theorem has some pretty significant applications, including the study of sums of independent random variables, a cornerstone of classical probability theory,
okay,
and also various problems in probability in Banach spaces. You know, those infinite dimensional vector spaces we mentioned earlier. Again, the proof uses induction and this clever monotonicity property for non-negative coordinates.
It's amazing how these seemingly abstract inequalities can have such concrete consequences for understanding random phenomena.
It really is.
Now, there's also this Theorem 3.3, which seems to have some connection to the classical Bernstein's exponential bound.
Yes. Theorem 3.3 resembles Bernstein's classical bound, which gives you limits on the probability of large deviations for sums of independent random variables. And Talleyrand's version involves this penalty function Euler, and it gives you a bound on the probability of deviating from some set $A in the product space. And Ledoux points out this interesting asymmetry in the variables that appear in this penalty function dollars, which is a key aspect of Talleyrand's approach. It reflects this distinction between the point you're trying to control and this fixed reference set $A.
So it sounds like Talleyrand's work really provided a whole new set of tools for tackling these concentration phenomena in product spaces. And these tools have had a huge impact across many areas of mathematics.
Absolutely.
Okay, our outline then shifts to the integrability and large deviations of Gaussian measures. It feels like we're coming full circle back to the Gaussian setting we started with.
We are, and Ledoux explains how these isoperimetric and concentration inequalities we've been talking about are really crucial for studying the integrability properties of what are called functionals of Gaussian measures.
Okay, functional. So functions that take other functions or random variables as input.
Exactly. And these inequalities are also essential for proving what are called large deviation statements, which basically quantify the probabilities of really rare events, events that are exponentially unlikely.
So integrability properties.
Yeah.
We're basically talking about figuring out when certain averages or expectations involving Gaussian random variables are well behaved when they're finite.
Exactly. So theorem 4.1 in the article, which is a classic result, gives you conditions for when the exponential of the squared norm of a Gaussian measure on a Banach space has a finite integral. And this theorem actually has a really fascinating history with contributions from many of the mathematicians we mentioned earlier: Gross, Skorohud, Fernike, Landau, Shep, and Kahan.
Wow. So a real collaborative effort over many years to really understand this property.
It really is.
And Ledoux mentions that you can also use the concentration inequalities to get these kinds of results. And sometimes they even give you stronger bounds, like the one in 4.4 involving the median of a Lipschitz function.
Right. So 4.4 is a more refined result than theorem 4.1 because it takes into account both the median of the Lipschitz function, which kind of gives you a sense of its typical value, and its Lipschitz norm, which we talked about earlier. It controls how fast the function can change.
Okay.
And these two parameters can behave quite differently, even in simple examples. So it's a more precise tool in certain situations.
Now, at this point, Ledoux brings in the concepts of abstract Wiener space and the reproducing kernel Hilbert space. And this feels like we're formally moving into the realm of infinite dimensional Gaussian measures. Pretty big jump in abstraction.
It is a crucial step for extending these ideas. So abstract Wiener spaces and reproducing kernel Hilbert spaces provide the right setting for dealing with Gaussian measures in these infinite dimensional settings. And you can think of the reproducing kernel Hilbert space, denoted by Mathcol as a kind of core space that captures the essential structure of the Gaussian measure, which we'll call Vlutz. This measure lives on a larger Banach space, $E. And the abstract Wiener space construction gives you a specific way to embed MathCal into dollars so that MathCal is a well-defined probability measure on AFCAL. It basically lets you translate concepts like neighborhoods and enlargements into these infinite dimensional spaces.
So it's a way to bring the geometric intuition we have from finite dimensions into this much more abstract setting.
Exactly.
And then Ledoux talks about the Cameron-Martin-Hilbert space, which is an important example of a reproducing kernel Hilbert space when you're dealing with Wiener measure, which, as we mentioned earlier, is the Gaussian measure on the space of continuous functions.
Right. And then theorem 4.3 gives you the Gaussian isoperimetric inequality in this abstract Wiener space setting. It basically says that if you have a set dollar with a certain inner measure, its enlargement by the unit ball to dollars of the reproducing kernel Hilbert space, MathCal, has a measure bounded below by a function related to the standard normal distribution.
Okay.
But here's a bit of a surprising fact. In infinite dimensions, the measure of MathCal itself under Neuters is actually zero.
Whoa, that's definitely counterintuitive. A Hilbert space sitting inside a bigger Banach space but having zero measure. That's wild.
It really highlights the strange things that can happen in infinite dimensions. And Ledoux also points out that you can get the concentration inequality in this abstract Wiener space setting, 4.6, pretty easily from that earlier proposition 2.1 we talked about, which shows you how powerful that initial result is. He also mentions Talleyrand's strengthening of theorem 4.1, which is theorem 4.4 in the article, and that gives you more precise information about how the measure of balls in Delo behaves asymptotically in terms of the reproducing kernel Hilbert space norm.
So this abstract framework provides a really deep way to understand Gaussian measures, even in these infinite dimensional settings.
It does.
And then Ledoux touches on the topic of large deviation principles.
Right, so large deviation principles are all about quantifying the probabilities of extremely unlikely events. And Ledoux talks about Schilder's result for Wiener measure and this more general framework developed by Donsker and Varaton. And then he presents a kind of non-topological approach to large deviations using these functionals, 3R2, Dollars, and C et al., which are related to enlargements of sets by balls in Anacant-Beller.
Okay.
And what's interesting is that this approach can actually improve on the classical large deviation results because it doesn't rely on the specific topology of the Banach space dollar.
So by focusing on this underlying structure provided by the reproducing kernel Hilbert space, you can get even sharper estimates for the probabilities of these rare events.
Exactly.
Finally, our outline mentions a connection to hypercontractivity.
Right. We already talked about the Ornstein-Uhlenbeck semigroup. And hypercontractivity is this fascinating property of the semigroup that relates its behavior in different a la Kalfour spaces, which are ways of measuring the size of functions.
Okay.
And it turns out there's a very deep connection between isoperimetry and hypercontractivity. And this connection is often made through something called the logarithmic Sobolev inequality.
Ah, the logarithmic Sobolev inequality. We've seen that pop up a couple of times in this discussion. It seems like a really fundamental idea.
It is, and it's probably a great topic for a future deep dive.
It definitely sounds like it. Well, this has been an incredible journey through these really fascinating concepts, isoperimetry and concentration. We've seen how these abstract ideas have been rigorously developed, particularly in the context of Gaussian analysis, and the incredible power they have for understanding all sorts of probabilistic phenomena.
Absolutely. And you now have a good understanding of why these tools are so important, not just in pure mathematics, but also in areas like statistics, probability in Banach spaces, random graphs, and even physics.
It's amazing how these core mathematical concepts underpin so many different fields. And I'm curious, what areas do you find most intriguing for the application of these ideas?
For me, it's the applications to high-dimensional probability and statistics. Mm-hmm. As we deal with increasingly complex data sets, these tools offer really valuable insights.
That makes sense. Well, if anyone wants to explore these topics further, Ledoux's book is a great resource, as is all the work by Talleyrand, of course. And definitely keep an eye out for that future deep dive on hypercontractivity. This deep dive has hopefully given you a solid foundation for appreciating the power of these ideas. This world of isoperimetry and concentration is vast, and it's still evolving. There's a lot more to discover. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.